Good evening. I'm Gerald Heeger, Dean of the New School, and I'm most pleased to welcome you here to this very special evening, this very special event, which is co-sponsored by the New School and the Nation magazine. I.F. Stone is an old friend of the New School, and we welcome him back. He has an honorary degree from this institution, awarded in 1978, and we constantly remind him of it. What is so appealing, I think, about this event, and I have a feeling what brings you here, is the very image of I.F. Stone conjured up by I.F. Stone's latest book. The very image of I.F. Stone and Socrates arguing with one another across the centuries. I cannot imagine a better set of protagonists. What I would like to do now is to begin our evening with I.F. Stone by introducing Victor Novasky, the editor of The Nation, who will in turn introduce our speaker. Thank you.
Thank you, Dean. Thank you, New School. Thank you, Nation Institute. Thank you, Esther, for making all of this possible. And thank all of you for coming, and congratulations on your presence. Since this event has been sold out for some weeks, you're either all very prescient or all very persistent, or you've come to collect on your unexpired subscriptions to I.F. Stone's newsletter, which last appeared in 1971. Now, happily, for those who didn't get in, we're trying to tape these proceedings, and there'll be tapes available. And for those who, or in case when you ask your questions later on, you don't speak into the microphone, for those who want to hear Izzy in print, we're all lucky that a young writer named Andrew Patner has taken the trouble to persuade Izzy to talk to him over the past months. And there is a book out now called I.F. Stone, A Portrait by Andrew Patner, which was published by Pantheon Books, which I commend to you. It's available. Now, either way, depending on how you got here, you know who Izzy is and what he's about, and there's no need for me to bore you with his biography. I won't go into the details of how he started at the top at age 13 with his little mimeograph newspaper in New Jersey in school. Printed, not mimeographed. See, already he's fact-checking me. And eventually he worked his way down to Washington correspondent of The Nation magazine, Washington editor of The Nation magazine from 1940 to 1946. As you know, he worked for PM in all of its various incarnations, and even for the New York Post pre-Rupert Murdoch. And speaking of Murdoch, you know, Izzy, too, was a press lord tyrannizing his staff of himself, working round the clock. Actually, Esther was de facto publisher, and people like Peter Osnos and others, other lucky ones, apprenticed to him during that period. But instead of going over his biography, let me say a few words about the Izzy that I have been privileged to know over the years by way of introduction. I first met I.F. Stone in the form of his porch. I was playing ball on Fire Island, and a tennis ball was, somebody missed catching a tennis ball, and when I asked them to go retrieve it, they said, "It's under I.F. Stone's porch." And that was meant that we weren't supposed to go and get this tennis ball because there were important things going on there and we weren't supposed to bother him. But I, being as persistent as you, wanting to meet him at some point, bided my time, and many years passed, and then in the year, I believe it was 1953, I was doing some work in the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C., and I spotted this man who looked very much like the Eye of Stone we saw through the window of his porch. And I introduced myself. And he tried to sell me a subscription to his his new publication that he was starting. So I didn't really get to know Izzy as I know him now, which is not the way some of you may know him, but until I came to The Nation, where I discovered what appeared to be a black mark against The Nation magazine in its history, because after a PM finally went down and Izzy was again available, The Nation, whether it was because it was short on cash as always or for whatever reasons, failed to pick up his option and put him back to work. Now, it's been reported elsewhere that at the time, Izzy felt that this was an injustice and a mistake on the part of Frieda Kirschway, who was then the editor-publisher of the paper, or the editor. But lest press historians mistake this as an error on the part of the late Mrs. Kirschway, why don't we agree, give her the benefit of the doubt, and just say that The Nation's great contribution to American letters was to liberate Izzy to publish his independent weekly, which started out with a few thousand readers and ended up with over 70,000 subscribers. Now, my first editing encounter with Izzy, I use that word advisedly, may tell you something about the man. We had dinner one night, and you know, it was my goal to get this guy to write for our magazine again after many years. And he suggested that we walk around the block after dinner. And in the walk around the block, he said he was getting on in years, and he wanted to do something that was up to the level of his energy, what he called his level of energy. And his idea was that he might do just a paragraph. He could do a paragraph a week, and that we could call it Izzy Says. And you know, I immediately thought of the old Will Rogers paragraphs. We could syndicate this throughout the country. We could get David Levine to do a little caricature to go with it. So Izzy seemed to think that was a good idea. So we got David Levine, and he did a little caricature. And a few days passed. Izzy called, and he had an idea for a paragraph. And he was kind enough to say what he thought, ask me what I thought of it. I thought it was a great idea. So he sat down to write his paragraph. And a few hours later, he called and he said that he had written the paragraph, but there was a problem. And I said, what was the problem? He said, well, the idea turned out to be a little too big for a paragraph. Could he have a second paragraph? So meanwhile, of course, our deadlines were passed. Our production person was there and had managed to have everything fit. It was down to this one paragraph with the caricature. So I said, well, Eye of Stone, yes, you can have the second paragraph. And so he hung up, and about an hour later, the phone rang again, and he said he's finished, he's ready to send it in. How should he send it in? It was great, and there was one little thing. What was that? That it actually didn't fit in two paragraphs. He had to add another paragraph. And so, we figured, that's okay. And so he put it in the mail, and sure enough, the next morning it arrived, and I was sitting there reading this quite brilliant perception that he had when the phone rang to ask whether we'd received it and to say that actually there had been developments overnight. And that he had gone down and read the wire service reports and done some other things that part of his magic, and he wouldn't feel right if he didn't add the necessary material. Was that all right with us? And we said, well, yes, of course, you know. So by the time we were done, we had a very beautiful piece that was a little longer than our normal pieces, but so while he was rarely able to get his actual energy level down to his theoretical energy level, we have been the happy recipients of occasional columns from Izzy ever since. Now, In reading through the reviews of The Trial of Socrates, Izzy's latest book, as you know, I've been interested to note three different positions of the reviewers. First, there are those who seem to have understood what he was about and attempted to grapple directly with what John Leonard in the pages of The Nation magazine called this altogether engaging, do-it-yourself philological meander, an owner's manual on free speech and class animus in ancient Athens. Second, there are those I think of as pedants who ask, where does a mere journalist, even one who in his 70s has taken the trouble to learn ancient Greek, get off writing about such a subject? And then finally, there are those who, also scholars, pedants, who concede that Izzy is or was a great journalist, and then go on to ask, where does a merely great journalist get off, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, aside from the irony in the fact that the so-called scholars are generally the ones who focus on credentials rather than the argument, I think there's been a fundamental misunderstanding here. Let me explain. Now, even before there was an I.F. Stone's Weekly, and even before PM, when he was still toiling for The Nation, and remember all of you staff members, he told Mr. Patner, I was not a clock watcher. Izzy was less a conventional journalist, even a merely great one, than he was a scholar. Let me give you an example, which I discovered this afternoon by opening, more or less at random, a volume of the magazine, went to the index and looked up one of his columns, from the July 29th, 1944 issue. It contained one of Izzy's weekly pieces, and it was entitled, in this case, Backward Areas. Now, I'm just going to read you the lead of the piece, the opening paragraph. I have been browsing through press releases by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the Committee for Economic Development. I've been browsing through Federal Reserve bulletins. He's still browsing here. Monthly bank letters from New York. League of Nations reports. The list goes on and on. I want to give him a chance to speak, so I won't go down. And he ends, and an exciting not-for-publication speech by a Swedish economist. And then he says, I suggest that in the post-war period, the world's most troublesome backward area will not be China or India, Africa or Latin America or the Balkans. The intellectual backwardness of the colonial areas is a less serious world problem than the intellectual backwardness of the American business community. Now, I mean, to me, that encapsulates both what scholars ought to be doing in the way of research in advance, and then the hypothesis clearly stated, and then the piece goes on to elaborate the hypothesis. Now, as has been said, as Dean Heger intimated, Izzy is himself a Socrates in the sense that he asks the troublesome questions. He has been a teacher to every serious journalist in the country, and many in the world. He is, or ought to be, a role model to mere scholars because his prodigious researchers always go to the heart of the matter, which is, as he once put it, to write the truth as I see it, to defend the weak against the strong, to fight for justice, and to seek as best I can to bring healing perspectives to bear on the terrible hates and fears of mankind in the hope of someday bringing about one world in which men will enjoy the differences of the human garden instead of killing each other over them. He is a friend, a colleague, and an inspiration. He's going to say a few words to us, and then, most uncharacteristically, he's going to answer rather than ask the questions. Please speak up into the microphones when that time comes. I'm just going to sit there and do nothing unless someone in the guise of asking a question starts to make a speech. Izzy, it's all yours.
It's very nice to be here with so many old friends, and I'm afraid the victor left me very little else to add. I do want to say one word about Frieda Kirchwey. I loved working for her. She was a wonderful person, and I don't like any criticism of her, even by implication. She had a very, very difficult financial situation, very difficult. On her hands when the weekly ended, and my first choice was to go back to work for the Nation. And she simply didn't know how to raise even the pittance that would have put me on, and she just wasn't able to. She didn't want to say no, and she wasn't able to say yes, and so I finally had to take things in my own hands and start the weekly. But it was not her fault in any way, and I enjoyed very much working for her. And I told Victor I was very pained by a review in the Nation last year about a rather superficial and empty book about her, and a superficial empty review that really did her a lot of injustice and hurt the feelings of a lot of her old friends, myself included. I was hoping to turn this into a kind of bull session seminar, and we have microphones in the aisles, and I don't know whether to start with an opening statement or not, because I do have a Does that mean people are glad I'm not going to make an opening statement?
You need to start with an opening statement.
As you could tell from Victor, I do have a tendency, an incurable tendency to producing Megillas. You know what a Megilla is? It's a scroll that just never ends. So I will say a word about what really concerns me most, and that is the situation in the Middle East. I think it's impossible to underestimate its gravity. It's split the Jewish community in Israel and split the Jewish community in America, I'm happy to say. At last, it's been split from being led by the nose by the so-called presidents of Jewish organizations who are tied to the Israeli government, and so that the Israeli tail can wag the American dog. It was time for the American Jewish community to take an independent position. I'm glad to say it is. But this can easily, and perhaps it already has, this whole situation gotten out of control to the point where it may lead to destruction for both the Palestinian Arabs and for Israel. And as you know, I started doing reporting on Palestine as far back as 1945. And I know a great deal about the idealism, sacrifice, and devotion that went into the building, the rebirth of the Yishuv in Palestine, and to have it in danger of being blown away after only 40 years is just dreadful. You know, by one of those curious paradoxes of political dynamics, the peaceniks in Israel And in 1980, after the victory of Reagan, had the hope that he would be strong enough to resist the very arrogant Zionist lobby in Washington and help to bring about, even to perhaps to some extent, impose a peace upon the area. And it looks as if in these last months, the administration, Schultz and Reagan, have girded up their loins to meet those expectations. I know all the pitfalls and weaknesses of the Schultz formula, which hasn't been entirely explained to us. And it's far from ideal. But we ought not to let a good start be discouraged because it isn't all the best we could have hoped for. This problem is so difficult, and like so many diplomatic problems, in fact, problems of quarrels and conflicts in civil life, it essentially becomes a kind of a task in squaring the circle. It looks very impossible, but Schultz is trying, and I think he should be supported, and I hope he succeeds. And I don't think it's possible, 20 years after the conquest of the occupied territories in the 20th century, to talk about having a Jewish state in Palestine and denying the Arabs the right to self-determination if they want a state of their own in the occupied territories. And I think it's also very unjust to ask the weaker party, the Palestinian Arabs, to recognize Israel's right to exist before the Israeli government is prepared in exchange to recognize their right to self-determination. It's just outrageous. It's just outrageous. And sooner or later, this revolt was bound to happen. I know all the dangers about peace and all the dangers about giving land for peace. And I understand the fears of those Jews who feel differently from what I do. And I recognize that a lot of those fears are justified. But I do think that here as elsewhere, the risks of peace are a lot better than the risks of war. And it isn't just a question of what we do with the Arabs. It's even more profoundly a question of what we do with ourselves. The soul of the Jewish people is at stake. The other day I read a story in the Washington Post, which has, like the Times, been giving very good coverage on this. And I think the Times, the New York Times editorial, has been very courageous as a great newspaper and a great Jewish community of New York to speak out as well as it has. I read a terrible story about a bulldozer brought out by the Israeli army in an obscure village I'd never heard of near Bethlehem, where a suspect sought by the army had taken refuge or hidden, or they were suspected of taking refuge and hiding, nobody knows, in an Arab farmer's olive orchard. And the army brought out a bulldozer and proceeded to level the gardens and the orchard. And the climax of the story was a difficulty it had in dealing with one olive tree up on a hillside that didn't want to give. You know, the olive trees are very gnarled, and it took a lot of work to put chains on the the olive tree and link it up to the bulldozer and finally tear it up. And the olive tree seemed like a symbol, because in the background of this dispute are certain elements in the Israeli community who would like to uproot the Arabs and drive them out, as well as the olive trees. Now, this business of imposing collective punishments, my God, have we so quickly forgotten about the Hitler occupation of Europe? Have we so quickly forgotten that the Geneva Pact that now governs the treatment of occupied populations and territories was an effort to prevent what happened in occupied Europe? Do we want the history books to say that we began to repeat in the occupied territories exactly the, or not exactly, but much the same kind of horrors that the German occupation imposed on Western and Eastern Europe? So I hope the split in the Jewish community continues to the point of real debate. There's been very little debate in the Jewish community in America. I don't read modern Hebrew, and I'm lost without points. But what I read in translation of the Hebrew press makes me very proud as a journalist. I think the Hebrew press and the Israeli courts have acquitted themselves very honorably and very splendidly. There's been a lot of freedom of discussion, but here, if you dare to criticize Israeli policy, you're a mumser and a heretic, and as I have really been since 1946, after my illegal trip, when I dared to express my nationalist views, and then in 48 began to talk about the problem of the Arab refugees. And I don't mind a lot, I'm used to it. I think that everybody who tries to get in, to be a good human being is sooner or later going to get in trouble with his own tribe. So that's a badge of honor. But I do hope, you know, this could, if war begins, and there are more scenes of horror, and war really is beginning, not at all impossible. We may see American troops in the Middle East. It'd be a very bad day for the American Jewish community if that happens. There are the seeds here of anti-Semitism. As some people have talked, some Jews have talked about breaking our ties with Israel. That's impossible. The diaspora and Israel will go down together. We can't break the ties. Israel can't live without the diaspora, and the diaspora depends a great deal upon how Israel behaves itself. The breath of life for us in the diaspora is separation of church and state. And by the way, Herzl, the founder of modern Zionism and his Judenstadt, spoke very strongly for separation of church and state, synagogue and state, and a new Jewish state. Tolerance, respect for minorities, pluralism, all these things more and more are being violated in Israel as well as in the occupied territories. And they undermine the basis of our security in the diaspora. And they undermine the moral foundations of Israel. And this is a very crucial fight for the future and the soul and the reputation of the Jewish people. I was so glad to see that Dr. Sigman of the American Jewish Congress had spoken out and broken ranks with the establishment, that the American Jewish Committee has a heretical publication now called Present Tense. I think we have the responsibility to bring the bear on the situation in the Middle East. Just those ideals that that we live by as Americans, and do our part in molding the outcome, and I guess that about sums up what I'd like to say as a starter, and I'll take your questions. And if you have a irrepressible desire to make a speech, you do have the 14th Amendment. You do have the First right. Amendment and the 14th Amendment, but if you're going to make a speech, make it short and don't make it a question or be excused. Right. But if you have some real questions, I'll try to answer them.
If it's possible to come up to the microphones to ask the questions, that will make life a lot easier, partly because WBAI is going to play this over the radio in the weeks ahead, and so whoever has one, unless it's you're sitting in the middle of a row and can't bear it, then you can shout it out and I will repeat it. But why don't we start over here?
Is he, I heard a debate the other evening on one of the local TV channels between Rabbi Balfour Brinkner and Ken Bialkin of the Conference of American and Major Jewish Organizations. It was an interesting representation of the debate that begins to take place. And I was somewhat surprised to learn in this debate, but the statement made by Rabbi Brinkner that part of the Camp David Accords, which Menachem Begin did not implement, required the development of some kind of local autonomous elections in the occupied territories. And I was just curious as to what could be done as part of the preparation for self-determination in that regard.
Well, it's very hard to sell autonomy to the Palestinian Arabs when the autonomy promises of the Camp David Accords were so quickly negated by Begin, and Carter had to acquiesce in it. It's very hard to sell the same bill of goods twice. I myself felt at the time of Camp David that it had constructive possibilities, and I felt that the Arabs should have taken them and built upon them. And I said to my Arab friend, you ought to do what the Zionists did, what we did, and add dunum to dunum, and take a little bit more than was offered, and push ahead, and make your voice heard. I think the Palestinian Arabs have been very poorly led. I think that, with all due respect, I think that I'm not against the PLO, like the Zionist movement. It's a spectrum of many different viewpoints, and I think the closing down of the PLO office here at the UN is a scandal that will hurt the American reputation in the world court when the thing is adjudicated. But I do think the leadership has been very poor on the whole, and that particularly the terrorism has helped Jewish extremism more than it's helped the Arab cause. I covered the Jewish terror against the British in 1946 or 1947, particularly in Palestine. I was against terror then, I'm against terror now. It's a very dubious weapon. But it's going to be very hard to ask them to accept autonomy, and very hard to get them to accept a formula that says that they have to be part of a Jordanian delegation. With all due respect to King Hussein, he runs a kind of biblical kingdom. His base are the Bedouins. He's like King David, so to speak. And the Palestinian Arabs have been among the most advanced and well-educated Arabs of the Fertile Crescent. They haven't been, the treatment of their leadership in Jordan has not been of the best. And they want to speak for themselves. They're adults. And they're a wonderful part of the Arab world. They've been called the Jews of the Arab world. They provide intellectuals and engineers and technicians. I'm a great believer in gestures in difficult situations. And if I had my way, I would have the Hebrew University in Jerusalem that I respect a great deal. It's a wonderful institution. Offer an honorary degree to Professor Edward Said of Columbia University as a product of Jerusalem and a kindred people, who's made a very distinguished record as a scholar in the outside world. A few gestures like that would go a long way. And of course, my dream about Jerusalem, and I think it's Teddy Kollek's too, and I knew Teddy Kollek in the Jewish underground. I have great respect for him and great respect for how well he has tried to do his difficult task as mayor of Jerusalem. But to have an Arab state in the occupied territories and a Jewish state, and then Jerusalem as a united city, but a dual capital, with the East Jerusalem, the Arab part, the old Arab part, the capital of the Arab state, and the other part of Jerusalem, the capital of the Jewish state, like two boroughs in New York, each borough a capital, but the city government, a united government, as a kind of a symbol of peace. So what was done, Rabbi Brichter is quite right, what was done to the autonomy promise then makes it very hard to get the Palestinian Arabs to take that formula seriously now. And that's why I think Secretary Schultz has been so insistent that the autonomy period be very limited, and within a year, the basic decision of the future of the occupied territories be settled.
Could future question askers identify themselves before they ask the question? The first one was from Maury Paffern of Fund for New Priorities. And since I see no other questions, the evening is over. No, I have a question, but and I'm the moderator, so I'll take the prerogative. But if you don't have questions, you've heard Izzy's paragraph, so we'll let Izzy speak. But let me ask my question, which has to do with why the Middle East isn't part of the debate of presidential politics. First part of my question. The second part is a craft question, which is, if you were, how ought one to cover the presidential campaign these days? If you were covering it, what would you do?
Well, that's a lot of questions in one.
Got a weak audience out here.
Nobody likes to be accused of anti-Semitism by saying anything which can horror reflects on Israeli policy. So, secondly, the Jewish community is a big source of funds for the election campaign. Nobody wants to to touch the subject. It's untouchable in large degree. And the campaign is really not a very inspiring campaign. When I think of the dreadful potential consequences of 8 years of Reaganomics for the future of our country, it may very well be that in a few months, either before the election or after the election is going to look like a very silly and blind affair that completely ignored so many of the basic problems of the American polity. But the results have not been entirely negative if you look at it objectively. On the Republican side, it's been a pleasure to see Robertson. We ought to give him the Gush Emunim. Fall flat on his face in the Bible Belt, which showed that the spirit of the American people and its comprehension of separation of church and state. Anyway, you only took one look at that greasy, oily, phony face to realize what kind of a faker he is. He's been pretty well downgraded. And then Haig, who really ought to go to a psychoanalyst, he suffers from the delusion that he ought to be Henry Kissinger, and he can't quite make it. A poor Goyisha boy who can't quite make his dream of being as big a finagler as Henry Kissinger. So, and he's a bit of a machugana too. I don't mean I'm a Kissinger, I mean Haig. So he's been pushed aside. And then on the Democratic side, I really think that that Gary Hart's a bit too flaky to be trusted in the White House. There have been lots of girls in the closet in the White House, at least going back to Harding's day. But there's something flaky about him, and also he's always talking about new ideas. We don't get any. And then it's been. And then I must say that I don't think the only Republican I ever cared for was Abraham Lincoln. But it's been a pleasure to see that one Marxist-Leninist in the Republican ranks, the only guy that stood up for the INF treaty at the initial debate, George Bush, forging ahead against Dole, who sounds so big and brave, but always sits on the fence, as he did yesterday on the Grove City case. So of all the Republican candidates, I'd rather have Bush forge ahead. But what happens is really going to depend on what happens to the stock market. If the market doesn't collapse before the election day, and if Reagan makes progress in Moscow and at least establishes the beginning of a START treaty that the next administration can work on, Republicans may win the election. But a lot is in the lap of the gods, and so many unexpected things can happen. I think that Jesse Jackson has made a great contribution to American politics by the way he's handled his campaign. He's by far the best informed. For example, on the business of this obscene nonsense about the Nicaraguan incursion into Honduras, it was interesting to have the president of Honduras say that Honduras has no proof that the Nicaraguans have left their territories. I have to stop and think about that. It reminds me of that near war between China and India, when the Indians one morning read a story in the Peking People's Daily indicating the Chinese troops had crossed through the Ladakh Plateau. So it looked like there was going to be a war over it. The Ladakh Plateau, if you forget, is a natural road between Tibet and the outermost western provinces of China. It's cut off from India itself most of the year, and the Indians didn't know what was going on there until the Chinese press tipped them off. So the same kind of thing here. I mean, it's a dense underbrush. Nobody knows what's happening. Nobody can see what's happening, and the government complains that it has no proof that they're. The troops have not left its territory. I mean, what kind of a dispute is that? And Bush kept his mouth shut about it. So I don't know what I would do if I was covering the campaign. I think maybe I'd go back to classical studies. I could say one thing to help warm you up for a discussion about me and the classical scholars. You know, one of the things that inspired me to venture into these long and lonely and very enjoyable labors was a remark made about a century ago by Jakob Burckhardt, the great Swiss historian of the Renaissance. And he also wrote a very good book on Griechische Kulturgeschichte, Cultural History of Greece, which hasn't been translated. And I haven't read it either in German. I just read the title to you. I don't want to. Anyway, but Burckhardt said that 100 years from the day, somebody will read Thucydides and find something we've all overlooked. I thought, aha, that's my cue. But Burckhardt should have added two other propositions. One was that anybody who read Thucydides and found things that the classical scholars had overlooked would have to be ready to be attacked for his temerity and impudence by the conventional scholars, and they would go right on overlooking it. And I'm so fascinated to see that in the reviews, either I get aspersions as just a journalist, or I get hearts and flowers as a wonderful journalist. But nobody really seems to deal with what I claim to be our new insights. Now, maybe I'm wrong. Why don't they get their chance to show my Greek is imperfect, and God knows it's far from perfect, or that I've drawn too sweeping inferences from inadequate evidence, or that I'm contradicted here and there. But the argument has been largely ad hominem. And one of the, you know, there are a couple of obstacles to inserting new ideas into the academic establishment. One is that with the tremendous explosion of human knowledge in all fields, it's very hard to master it all the way Aristotle did or tried to do. And it's really very hard to understand the basic problems of philosophy and politics and human society if you just take one little corner of it, because it's one continuous web. I mean, maybe the Egyptians were different when they built the pyramids, but ancient Athens is yesterday, and the problems are all there. Understand Plato without Wittgenstein or without William James. And somebody said to me, a woman in the New York Times Book Review said all these problems were settled 20 years ago when they beat the hell out of Popper before he got to be a sir. That kind of scared them a little bit, so they laid off him. But the truth is, the attack on Plato didn't end or start with Popper. It started with Aristotle, and Aristotle's attack in the Politics on the, he didn't use the word totalitarian, which is a new word, but on the totally totalitarian character of his utopia is more devastating than anything that Warner Feit in his brilliant book on the Platonic delusion, or Richard Crossman in his wonderful book Before the War on Plato, or Sir Karl Popper delivered. And indeed, Socrates got all his own disciples very confused, as St. Augustine points out in the City of God. For example, you all know what the great nominalist-realist controversy is in the Middle Ages between those who held the nominalist point of view that abstractions are mere names and empty sounds, and that the only realities are particulars, and the idealists who said that the ideas, Platonic style, were the only reality. That debate really begins in the Socratic family with Antisthenes. The oldest disciple of Socrates, Antisthenes, was the first nominalist. And Plato went one way by doing what Francis Bacon attacks in the Novum Organum. And when he attacks the idols of the mind, he says one of the idols is turning abstractions into things, what we now call reification. And so Plato, in despair of absolutes, one of the most important things I was trying to say in the book is that if you believe in absolute ideas and the possibility of obtaining absolute truths, you are going to create a very dreadful society and a totalitarian society. I'm not blaming all of Plato and Socrates, but Socrates sought for absolute definitions. Absolute definitions are unobtainable. Definitions are very important. They're only the starting point of a problem. And this led Plato to his ideas of forms. You see, one way to understand this great dispute is to read Plato and Aristotle together as an ongoing dialectic and dispute between a great philosopher and his greatest pupil. And it's not an either-or proposition. It's not whether Plato was right and Aristotle was wrong. They all looked at things differently, and their different views provide different insights and make a different contribution. But Plato came out of Pythagoreanism with its belief that the secret of existence lay in mathematics. And in mathematics, at least before non-Euclidean geometry and Boolean algebra, both of which I know very little about, but they're different. But in the days of Euclidean geometry, if you knew the axioms, you knew the corollaries, There was no need for free debate. Either you're right or you were wrong. But that's hardly a model for the complex and the interwoven disputes and problems of human beings in human societies. And the effort to find it and the belief it could be found led him to the idea of philosopher kings, but only his kind of philosopher. The essential premise of a free society is the idea that men have a right to pursue passionately their view of the truth, but they have to keep open part of their minds for the fact that it's an argument that goes on forever, and is never going to be solved. And the basic premise of a free society is that absolute truths are unattainable. Everybody has a right to try to attain them, but there was a great medieval cardinal, Nicholas of Cusa. Very few people know about a very divine and fragrant character who believed in the unknowability of God. The unknowability of God is a familiar feature of Islamic, Jewish, and Christian philosophy, Christian theology. He had a peculiar variant of it, which he foreshadowed the calculus and used the polygon and the circle and the curve and the tangent to show that you could never understand the mystery of God, that you could approach it but never get to it. And from this, he inferred that every religion should be treated with respect. And he wrote a wonderful ecumenical dialogue called De Pace Fidei, in which St. Peter presides in heaven over a meeting of Roman Catholics, Greek Orthodox, Hussites, Jews, and Muslims, all come together peacefully to discuss the wonders and mysteries of the Godhead. And what applies to the Godhead really applies to all of human knowledge. Tremendous. There are areas of unknowability that we yearn to get to, but can't quite. And that kind of a view generates respect for others, as it did for Cusa and his attitude toward the other religions, and a willingness to tolerate them and to live in peace with them. And that's what one needs to do in a free society and a healthy society. Wherever you have a church or a party that believes it has the truth, and Fichte once made a remark, a dreadful Germanic remark, that if you know the truth, you have an obligation to impose it. So that is part of what I was talking about in the book. And a lot of the scholars, they've been brought up on a lot of Plutarchian myths and myths out of Diogenes Laertius about the treatment of the philosophers in Athens, a lot of nonsense. Philosophers were treated very badly and regarded with suspicion in ancient Rome, where the radicalism of the Gracchi were blamed on a Greek philosopher, Blosius, and where Cato blew his top and drove a lot of philosophers out of Rome at one point. The Empire Domitian did again a couple of years later. So Roman Empire writers imagined the same thing must have happened in Athens, and it didn't. And then one scholar gave me a very nice review, but he said Athens wasn't all that free. It had slavery. It didn't have women's suffrage. And what was the third thing it didn't have? I forget. But it's a silly way to look at the ancient world. Everybody had slavery. So the fact they had slavery, you have to condemn them all. You look at it rationally, you ask, what kind of slavery? And what were the slave codes? Now, the best slave codes in antiquity were the Hebrew code in the Bible and the Athenian code. And the Athenians didn't have those huge gangs of slaves on the latifundia of ancient Rome. A craftsman or a trader would have one or two free workers and one or two free slaves whom he could hire out, and they could share their earnings and buy their freedom. It wasn't all that, and Plato sneers at the fact in the streets of Athens you couldn't tell a slave from a free man. But what's that got to do with freedom of speech? They did have freedom of speech to a very high degree, and very few other places had it. So why deny it? Why bring in human suffrage, women's suffrage? We didn't have that till this century, and I'm glad we have it. But what's it got to do with judging? It's the first thing that uneducated kids say. Well, they didn't. They had slavery, and they didn't. They didn't have equality of women. So the issues have not been met, and a lot of nonsense has been generated. And of course, this is the familiar complaint of every author about reviewers. So. I'm open to that accusation, too. Now, let's have some questions.
We've got a gentleman here. Why don't you do it?
You made some reference to Jesse.
Well, identify yourself first, please.
Yes, Norman Barish, a charter subscriber to IO Stone Weekly. You made some reference to Jesse Jackson, and I wonder if you would comment on... what you think his relationship with the Jewish community is in America, and should he become president now or later, what kind of president you think he would make?
Well, it's always a gamble what kind of president a man will make. It's like picking a doctor for an operation. You don't find out till it's too late. I think that Jackson has paved the way. I think that 8 years hence, maybe, if all goes well, we might have a black president. It'd be a wonderful thing, and it might be Jackson. And but I don't think he could be elected this year. And while he has some white support, and it was a pleasure to see the support he got in lily white areas of the Middle West and New England, it made me very proud of America. Because the whole human race is racist, is very racist, and I think we do more about it, worry more about it, as we should, than most countries, including Israel. As for Jackson and the Jewish community, I was very pained by that Hymetown crack. I love New York. It's one of the great Jewish cities of all time, like Alexandria. I don't know why you're laughing. It makes me think of Alexandria and Vienna and Berlin and the great cities where Jewish intellectuals were part of all the fizz and the excitement and the arts and the thought. And that's what New York is like. It's among its other virtues, it's one of the great Jewish cities of all time. And I love it. I love it. I was talking in 92nd Street Y on my Socrates series. I'll get back to you in just 1 second. something happened that couldn't have happened anywhere else in the world, including Oxford and Cambridge, in my opinion. I haven't talked at Cambridge, I haven't talked at Oxford. But I was talking about the Emperor Julian and about one of his assistants named Libanius, who wrote a forgotten apology, but one of the few other surviving apologies. And I said, if you want to know more about the Emperor Julian, let us choose, rebuild the temple. And I said, if you want to know more about him, you want to read that novel, The Twilight of the Gods. And for a minute, I couldn't remember the author's name. And I said, who remembers, who wrote The Twilight of the Gods? And I swear, three people shouted, Merezhkovsky, and I don't believe there's another audience in the world where there have been three really wonderful old-fashioned Jewish intellectuals who knew about this wonderful Christian mystic, Dmitri Merezhkovsky, and this wonderful trilogy, which includes the Twilight of the Gods. It's part of my love of New York. And I think it should be forgiven. And I don't like to see bad feeling between the Jewish and black communities. So I don't like to talk too much about it. I think he's run a very intelligent campaign. Oh, by the way, I forgot to add, on the Nicaraguan incursion, he was the only candidate who spoke about the right of hot pursuit. The Nixon's... Nixon invoked that for the invasion of North Vietnam and Laos and Cambodia on the ground that the guerrillas had a privileged sanctuary across the border, and international law recognizes the right of hot pursuit. Whether it was hot pursuit in this case, I don't know. Whether they actually got over across the border, I don't know. It's a terribly exaggerated affair altogether. But Jackson was the only person who said hot pursuit and added a new dimension of information to the whole debate. And I think he has grown, and I have a lot of respect for him. But he's still pretty much a black and to some degree Hispanic candidate, and I don't think that he could win an election this year. And I could be wrong.